Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. With some exceptions, white men have historically held positions of authority in almost all social, political, and professional realms. That's beginning to change slowly as we recognize that diversifying our leaders promotes positive change and leads to greater achievements and success. Today, we talk with three women about their path to leadership positions, what it takes to be a good leader, and thoughts on how to prepare more diverse individuals for future leadership positions. And with us is Sandra Stosch. She's Vice Admiral in the U.S. Coast Guard, retired, and the first woman to head the Coast Guard Academy. Her recently published book is titled Breaking Ice and Breaking Glass, Leading in Uncharted Waters. Good morning, Sandy.
Good morning, Mindy. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
And then Judy Walden Scarifile, sports journalist, pharmacist, and retired president of the Cape Cod Baseball League. Hi, Judy.
Good morning. Thank you for the invitation.
You bet. And Dorothy Savarese is in studio with me. She's the chair and CEO of Cape Cod 5. She's also been appointed by the Federal Reserve and the FDIC to serve in advisory roles and served as chair of the American Bankers Association. Hi.
Hi, Mindy. So great to be here with you and to be with these other gals.
Yeah. All three of you are very accomplished women in fields that have traditionally been dominated by men. I want to start our discussion at a point well before you reached those positions in childhood and young adulthood. And looking back, what were some of the experiences you had or interests that came into bloom during this period and helped shape the path that took your life, took your later life? Sandy, you write about some early family experiences with your family in the book. So let's start with you.
Thank you, Mindy. And I'm always going first. I was the oldest of four children, all of us within 3 years and 10 months of age. And I always had to go first for the hard stuff and last for the easy stuff. I was the only girl, and it was three brothers, and the oldest. And I think that really mattered. And experiences that helped shape my character and core values were some of those having to go first at a young age. And I also, like you said, reading in the book, I worked on farm work up at my grandmother and my grandparents' farm in the Connecticut River Valley when I was just a young teenager, 13 to 16 years old. I worked picking cucumbers and picking tobacco, of all things. And I really learned the value of hard work and perseverance. And those are my core values. Hard work, perseverance, combined with humility and honesty are core values that I learned in childhood that helped shape my character and prepare me for some of the challenges and opportunities that I would have later in life.
How about you, Judy?
Wow, that's a tough act to follow. My goodness. Sandy, you've had a lot of practice going first. I think in growing up, there was really never any difference between boys and girls in what you wanted to do. I mean, girls played soccer, baseball, softball. I mean, we did the same thing that the boys did. There wasn't a lot of hoopla about making a difference. I was very interested in chemistry early on in grade school. And at that point, you know, going into a field in science was still guys. But my parents just encouraged what I wanted to do and where my interests were. And it was just, there just wasn't a distinction about you can't do that because that's what boys do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What about you, Dorothy?
There just wasn't a difference.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so interesting. Well, as opposed to Sandy, I'm the second to last out of eight children.
Oh.
So I always went almost last. But being in a family that large really helped me understand different perspectives and the value of teams. Mm. And to this day, you know, when people talk about how I interact, it is frequently in groups and with teams because people bring such unique things to the table. So that was a big influence. My family also had a major focus on service. That was a value that was deeply embedded. You know, now, even though, you know, as Judy said, parents were open to children doing anything. You know, when I grew up, there really was a difference between what boys and girls did. And so I was always characterized as a tomboy. Mm-hmm. That was the word for somebody who wanted to play baseball and basketball and hunt in the woods and, you know, things like that. But and I did always have a book in my lap in school. And so I'm intensely curious about everything. And that's another thing that's influenced my life.
Judy, as a young woman, did you feel others had expectations for you that were based on your gender and not your interest or skill? I mean, you said your parents didn't, but do you think others did or not so much?
No, I don't think so. I didn't experience that. Was I hanging around with kids who wanted to be more in the traditional, in the 60s, the traditional female roles, school teacher, a nurse, you know, back in the 60s, how many men did you know in the nursing field? I had friends who were interested in that, but I don't think that, you know, was any influence on me or in any way.
How about you, Sandy?
No, I was treated just like my brothers. My parents had both gone to college. They had met at University of Massachusetts, Amherst, in fact. And I was raised as a tomboy, too. I am interested to hear this theme.
Yeah.
And I had most of my brothers, their friends were always over. So I did play as a child more with boys than with the girls. And I always wanted to be something different.
Yeah.
I always had the aspiration to do something unique and challenging and adventuresome. And I was born in 1960. And the reason I say that was because the Title IX came into effect in 1972, and then the Equal Rights Amendment in 73. And I was going into high school just a year or two after that. So I had the advantage of playing sports with actual Title IX support, where the high school assigned a track coach to the women's track team, the girls' track team. Mm-hmm. And I think that really mattered, that I was privileged to have those acts of law that came and supported my opportunity, gave me the open door. And following that, in 1976, all the service academies opened to women, and I was able to go to the Coast Guard Academy and achieve that unique lifestyle of adventure and service.
Yeah, I was a tomboy too.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, isn't that funny? And I had a lot of brothers. I played a lot with boys, too. My sister was the outcast. So, Dorothy, were there individuals who influenced you or served as role models as you were coming of age and as a young woman?
Yes, and many. But I do want to just comment on something Sandy said, because I'm just a few years older than she is.
Me too.
And in the fifth grade, at career day, I approached a Navy person. Because I wanted to be a jet pilot so I could be an astronaut. And he let out a belly laugh and said, "Ha, ha, ha, well, we'd have to put a whole new head on a Coast Guard carrier." And I'm thinking Coast Guard because of Sandy, you know, on an aircraft carrier. And I said, okay, you're telling me that that would be the obstacle for the Navy allowing me to be a jet pilot. So as opposed to these guys, the outside world always did throw up a lot of gender framed obstacles. That was interesting. And so for me, some of my icons were people like Katharine Hepburn, who seemed to overcome, you know, some of those gender obstacles. Obviously, because we so frequently see males in leadership positions, you know, Lincoln, you know, has always been, I studied Roosevelt and Churchill very extensively. I draw a lot from history. So, but I did keep recognizing that a lot of my idols were, in fact, male. And so I've spent a lot of time seeking female idols to admire.
Sandy or Judy, you have thoughts on that?
I just want to add, while we're talking about Navy and military service and tomboys and doing odd things, I wanted to be the first woman on Venus.
Well,
yeah, I grew out of that one, but
I actually took the test. My cousin was a year older than I am, and she joined the Navy when she graduated high school. And we were supposed to graduate and go to California together, right? So I thought, okay, well, she joined the Navy, maybe I'll join the Navy too. So a girlfriend and I, we went down to take the test, and the first thing the guy, you know, he splits up, "You over there," and I thought, "Who do you think you're bossing around right here?" Right. I'm going to do really well. And then I took the test. I'm like, these are all like mechanic questions, like. I didn't do very well on this test, and I was a good test taker. So I, right away, I could see the Navy was not going to work for me. Yeah.
Hey, Mindy, I just want to say something on what Dorothy was saying, and it's interesting because, yeah, my role models were mostly men, and as I got older in my career, I had to search for those women role models. But I will say that my grandmothers were both role models for me, mm-hmm. and they were both really strong women who talk about going through challenges. Right. And we can't even complain about challenges now, yet we somehow find a way to complain anyway.
Yeah.
But my grandmothers both went through, and I won't go into it here, but lots of hardship in their day. But my role models were mostly men. In fact, when I was a young girl, I got to say, I'm not just saying this, but Larry Bird was my hero. And you know why? Because he was not just a great basketball player, but he was, a character of character. He knew how to win with dignity and how to lose with dignity. And he was a team player. And I admired all those qualities.
Yeah. Sandy, you were accepted to the U.S. Coast Guard Academy at a time when there weren't many female cadets. After graduation, you were often the only female crew member on Coast Guard vessels. Do you think military service and the clear chain of command made it easier or more difficult to be other in those situations?
Oh, I think it made it easier. And I don't say that to make it look like it's easy for women in the military. But look, we came in with an organizational chain of command where there were expectations that you now have women, they come into boot camp or into the academy, whether it's officer or enlisted accession sources, you're thrown into teams where you can't pick your teammates, and you can't succeed unless you rely on each other. So you all have to respect each other, find the strengths of the individuals, put them together towards the team. And I do think it made it easier for women and minorities to succeed in the armed forces, where you've got the structure and there is a culture of respect. Yeah, does every organization have its challenges and have to work on improving that all the time? Sure. But we had expectations that were clearly established, and accountability and responsibility. Hmm.
Dorothy, how common was it early in your career to be the only woman at the table?
Oh, well, let me just say this. There was never a line at the ladies' room. I was actually at a conference one time where there was 500 people and there was like three women. This is very, very early on. And so we're like, hey, we could stay here all day. You know, there's nobody waiting to get in here. You know, obviously in banking, that is a very, I was in economic development before I was in banking. That was a lot more integrated, although, you know, still heavily male. When I moved into traditional banking, I felt like I'd moved back a few decades, you know, because of the heavy dominance of male management and women do support functions or women are tellers, you know, that mm-hmm. sort of thing. It was so interesting when I, and this is a true story, when I was made CEO 16 years ago, I was at an event and a banker came up to me and said, oh, I understand you're the weak sister that they put in place so that they could sell the bank. Well, 16 years later, I'm still here and the bank is still just as committed to its independence. But it was shocking because normally it's unconscious bias, you know, or not stated bias. So I was almost always the only woman in the room.
Judy, you also had the experience of being the only female in the sports press pool covering events. Talk about some of your experiences being the only woman.
Yeah, so I was the only woman for a long time, but I don't know if I just had my nose to the grindstone or my head in the clouds. I'm not sure, but I never really realized that. I never made a big deal about it. Nobody else made a big deal about it in college until one day a reporter decided he was going to interview me in a big splash in the Hartford Current. And I said, what's the big deal? I'm just doing my job. I was an official scorer at UConn and I wrote for the school newspaper. And I didn't understand why anyone could make a fuss because I was a woman doing a job. Didn't matter if I was a woman or a guy, who cared? But apparently it was a big deal. And then it became a bigger deal. My one anecdotal story, which is the only reason I have 2 minutes of fame, mm-hmm. is I was thrown out of the Yankee Stadium press box for being a woman. Mm-hmm. And my claim to fame is I was the first woman in the Yankee Stadium press box and the first one thrown out. And that was in 1970. And I couldn't believe it. It wasn't even during a Yankee game. It was during a Cape League All-Star game against the Atlantic Collegiate League, which was a similar league in New York. The press box held 50 people. There were four seats taken. I was one of the four seats. It's not like I was taking a spot that was going to go to a guy. And I wasn't allowed to sit there because I was a woman. But I was sitting there, so I was literally physically removed.
Mm. Wow.
And I dug my heels in for as long as I could. And this maintenance guy came over, security guy, and put his, believe it now, I'm saying this in this century, he put his arm on my bicep and said, "You've got to go."
Wow.
And he put me in the seats one row behind the press box. And I looked out on all empty seats in front of me in the press box.
Wow.
How ridiculous.
Yeah. We are talking with three women about their path to leadership positions, what it takes to be a good leader, and thoughts on how to prepare more diverse individuals for future leadership positions. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking with three women about their path to leadership positions and what it takes to be a good leader and thoughts on how to prepare future leaders. With us is Sandy Stowe. She's Vice Admiral in the U.S. Coast Guard, retired, and the first woman to head the Coast Guard Academy. Her new book is Breaking Ice and Breaking Glass, Leading in Uncharted Waters. Judy Walden Scarafile, sports journalist, pharmacist, and retired president of the Cape Cod Baseball League, and Dorothy Savary's chair and CEO of Cape Cod 5, who's also been appointed by the Federal Reserve and the FDIC to serve in advisory roles, and she has also served as chair of the American Bankers Association. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We all experience challenging situations, but how we handle those situations and the choices we make in those moments can become defining moments later. Dorothy, can you think of a particular situation that in hindsight maybe marked a turning point in how you thought of yourself on the path that your career took?
Well, there were so many. And one of the choices was, I've always been very committed to the environment, but I had sort of made my way into economic development locally. And I had the choice of either doing that at a national level or working for a national nonprofit that was focused on the environment. And I felt that my skills had a more immediate and tangible impact and I was more aligned to serve people at that point in time, and that there were others who were more capable of supporting the environment, and that I could do that in my spare time. That was a major fork in the road and a very difficult decision, but I had to look at it through the grid of aligning my aptitudes and my competencies with the difference that I felt that I could make in serving others.
How about you, Judy?
Going back to the Yankee Stadium incident, I came back to Cape Cod because this was 1970. It was my first year in the Cape League. And I realized my biggest decision was going to be, am I going to make waves about this? Because it certainly was a story. And Betty Friedan and Gloria Steinem, it was, you know, the big time with the Now movement. And, or am I going to suck it up? Because at that point, I was thinking of a possible career in sports, or, you know, Major League Baseball, or, you know, all the young people's dreams that work in sports. And I decided to suck it up, which, if you know me, is generally not my personality. So I literally had to just not exactly turn the other cheek, but I had to bury it and not make waves about it. Because I knew if I made waves in this completely male-dominated world of sports, that would be the end of anything I'd ever want to do.
Yeah. It's such a tough choice, too, you know, because we've all been there where it's like, okay, do I make a big deal of this or do I just let it go? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's a hard decision. Sandy, what about you?
First, I'll make a comment about inflection points and career transitions. And we all are going to face those from the time we're young, as young adults, all the way up until we're retirement eligible. Even retirement is an inflection point. And yet we seem to sometimes be afraid of those inflection points and hold back. So I think we should embrace the inflection points when they come and look for the opportunities, not shrink back and be fearful of the challenges. And when I reached a career inflection point, and I had several, one was after serving 12 years at sea, I was getting to be a more senior officer. And I'm like, what's next for me? Another ship? And I thought, what is it that I really love about being at sea? Was it the sunrises, seeing all the stars in the Milky Way, or something adventuresome, like a big mission where you're saving someone's life? And I thought, you know, it's not really. It's looking down from the pilot house where I would be standing my watch and seeing young people who just reported out of recruit training. So they're brand new 18-year-olds and they're unconfident. They don't know the Coast Guard. They mess up and get yelled at. But then 2 weeks later, they're hauling on a line with confidence. And I'm like, it's people. So going back to what Dorothy said, at a certain stage of my life, I also came to feel that my passion lied with the people and developing the next generation of leaders. And I asked, instead of going back to command another ship, to go and command our recruit training center, the boot camp, where the young people come in from all over America and we grow them into those young leaders of character.
Yeah. So, Sandy, how would you describe your leadership style and what or who helped you shape that style?
I've thought about this because there's all kinds of fancy monikers for leadership styles today, right? You've got empathetic leaders, you've got things. So the only one that resonates with me, because there's just a lot to unpack in these types of leadership styles and what we call them, is servant leader. And that comes from an ingrained commitment to serving a purpose bigger than myself with the Coast Guard mission. So we're serving America, the citizens of the United States, the people. We're serving a bigger cause. And you're also serving the people who report to you, your employees, and keeping that balance of service, how you balance service to your nation, service to your organization, and service to your people, that dynamic tension. You have to be a servant leader to keep that perspective.
Dorothy, how about you?
Well, Sandy just took the number one thing for me, so I'll have to think of another. No, I completely concur with everything that she just said, and that absolutely drives me. You are a servant to the people you lead as well. So you're a servant to the people that you serve and to the people you lead. But the other and as Sandy said, there's a lot of categories, but collaborative is the major, adjective I think that people would assign to my leadership style. I am such a believer that if you can, that we all together are greater than any of us alone. And it doesn't matter what the endeavor is, that makes such a difference. And everybody has something to offer. Mm-hmm. And no matter how you encounter them or, whatever. And so collaboration can take place even in the most unexpected settings. But I do believe that the combination of the collaboration and a growth mindset, that Carol Dweck has so beautifully laid out, are two critical parts of a leader to which I aspire to.
Mm-hmm. How about you, Judy?
Well, it has been said before more eloquently than I could have put it, but I think my style is stressing the importance of being a team player, so that at times, maybe people can't figure out who the leader is, and that's okay. I think one thing I really was very intent on doing is being in the trenches with people. If it was working in a concession stand at a ball game because somebody had a long line and they just were short on volunteers, who cares? I'll just jump in and help them. I wasn't trying to be a hero. I was just trying to be another pair of hands. So I think for me, it was just really important to show the value of playing as a team. And if I was a team leader, that's okay, but you just had to get everybody involved. I always wanted people's opinion, maybe to a fault. I tried to poll people to get an idea of what they wanted to do. I wasn't dictatorial, and at times that may have been a fault, but I think the all-inclusiveness is very important in having people work together. And at times it was hard to get 10 teams together to move as a single unit. Dave Willard used to talk about the mothership and the little rowboats. It was a pretty good analogy, but you need to get all those rowboats moving with the mothership so that everybody's striving for the same thing, which is the quality of the baseball on the field, a great experience for our volunteers, and just, you know, what we give to the community in terms of bringing wholesome family entertainment.
How would you counsel young women or those who might feel or be perceived as other in their field to find a leadership style that feels genuine to them? Who wants to go first?
I'll go first because okay. I always have to go first.
Go ahead, Cindy.
So I love the way you use the word genuine, Mindy. I'm not a fan of authentic, because this whole new movement to bring your authentic self to work is like, people don't want to see my authentic self. I wouldn't impose my authentic self on people at work, especially without my coffee. I think we need to compose ourselves, present ourselves in a professional demeanor. And sometimes that's not who we are. I'm an introvert. Mm-hmm. I have to present myself as something different than that many times in my career. I would counsel young women to believe in themselves and don't listen too hard to what other people try to make them be. So believe in yourself and try to develop the confidence to be that person that you know you are, and do something hard and succeed at it, or have the courage to fail, but keep doing something hard so that you can prove to yourself, yes, I'm worth believing in and I can do what I've set out to do.
Judy, talk about the importance of confidence and how your style of transmitting confidence has evolved.
Well, much like Sandy said, you know, be yourself. Don't try to be something that you're not. I think, you know, if you set your goals on something and you're still in a predominantly male-dominated field, basically you have to work twice as hard. I think one of the biggest challenges is making people realize you're serious at what you want to do and that gender doesn't have anything to do with it. You see a job, you see a goal, you have passion about what you're doing, and go for it. But work twice as hard.
Dorothy, she just said something really passion, right? Passion's contagious. I mean, when you have passion about something, whether you're, you know, male, female, whatever, it's like that passion comes through. Confidence
yes.
and passion are a good
yes.
combo.
But you can also ignite it in others, mm-hmm. right? I think it's like a flame, right, that can spread to other people and get them aligned and looking forward at the goal. So one of the things that, you know, what Judy's saying about the goal, I think is so important too, because if you focus on the goal and everybody's desire to get there instead of look at me, I'm your leader, then you can help young women recognize that the goal is to drive people forward and help them attain those goals, not like I'm telling you what to right. do. I think people frequently confuse leadership with I'm telling you what to do. Very different
yeah.
things.
Despite reaching a leadership position or being successful in a career, there can be times of self-doubt, right? Yuki from Falmouth emailed us to say, my one piece of advice as someone who has bad chronic imposter syndrome is that helps to take an event or anxiety and reframe it with the phrase I'm excited about. Rather than I'm worried about this presentation, I say I'm excited about the presentation. In acknowledging the stress, it helps reframe something as a task that can be completed. Good point, right? There's
Love
a lot
that.
To be said about, you know, you've got a big speech and everybody gets a little nervous when you have to get up in front of a crowd, right? But if you're kind of thinking and you're thinking through and you're going, I'm going to be great. It does help that, I mean, still nervous, but it seems less so, right? You feel prepared, I guess.
You know, Dorothy Sarnoff wrote a book because a thousand years ago, I did have a lot of apprehension about public speaking. And she said, say the three things to yourself. I'm happy I'm here. I'm happy you're here. I know what I know. And that's a mantra that many actors have used and things like that. There's another inspirational speaker who said, say to yourself, I get to do this.
Right. That's a good point. Yeah. Have any of you experienced imposter syndrome, as Yuki's saying, or gone through periods of doubt about your abilities or achievements? And if so, how did you handle those moments? You're nodding your head, Dorothy. Go ahead.
Of course.
We all have.
You know, what
right?
woman doesn't, you know, and perhaps men, but I'm not a man. I don't know. No, I mean, it is very funny. You think I'm just me, right? And of course, you know, I've been in circumstances because of national leadership roles and things like that. And when people react in a certain way to me, like, oh, you're important. And I think, oh, heavens, no, you're so sadly mistaken. It's just me. So I think, this is do what I say, not what I do. I have a lot of friends who do a lot of journaling. And one of the things they focus on in their journaling is to write down your accomplishments. Because when you do that, when you suffer from imposter syndrome, you can go back and you can review that and you can say, well, you know, as Stuart Small used to say, you know, I'm good enough, yeah. I'm right, and yeah. I'm darn, you know, whatever that is. So I think you have to do, and I know you're going to have a program on self-talk, you have to constantly work on self-talk so that you're not tearing yourself down, but instead recognizing I've done all this and I can do this.
Yeah. Sandy or Judy, want to add anything to that? You're nodding your head, Sandy.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And I'm thinking as I listen to Dorothy, yes, I mean, I speak for myself. I wouldn't speak for all women or men, but I felt like in over my head or, you know, am I really up to this, which is ridiculous, but it's something that we have to deal with. But, you know, rather than just talk about what we're doing as individuals to deal with it, how about helping other women so they don't have to deal with it. So reach out your hand and find somebody in your organization, if you're a leader, who's in the middle. They're not your star performer. They're not the person who's always having to be pushed to do more. They're in the middle. They don't get recognized and they fly beneath the radar, and give them a compliment someday. Tell them, hey, I saw something in what you did today there with that piece of production that you created. Mm-hmm. You really have talent. And then 5 years later, you'll have an email from this person saying, you know, that comment you made turned my life because mm-hmm. no one else ever believed in me. So we as leaders pay it forward and spend time every day finding somebody to lift up so that they aren't stuck with that imposter syndrome. Mm-hmm. We can cure that by reaching down and reaching out to bring other people in so that we help to make them see their value.
No, oh, that's such a good point, Sandy. I'm so glad you mentioned that. Such a good point. Yeah. Judy, you want to
I'll just add that, I'm nodding my head because mentoring has been so important in my life. And again, maybe my head was in the clouds. I didn't realize I was mentoring at the time. But 5 years later, you find out that someone you've been working with or helping along the way winds up working for the Cincinnati Reds. And you thought, well, okay, maybe I played a little bit of a role. So I think mentoring has been so important, particularly in the sports world for women, because they can use a little guidance. They can see that they can reach their goal if they just really, really work hard and be flexible. I mean, I wanted to work in Major League Baseball. It didn't happen. So what was my flexibility? I wound up in the Cape League and I have no regrets at all. I am so blessed to have had that opportunity for almost 50 years.
866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We're talking about leadership and we'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with three women about their path to leadership positions, what it takes to be a good leader, and thoughts on how to prepare more diverse individuals for future leadership positions. With us is Sandy Stowes, Vice Admiral in the U.S. Coast Guard, retired and the first woman to head the Coast Guard Academy. Her new book is Breaking Ice and Breaking Glass, A Leading in Uncharted Waters. Judy Walden-Scarifile, sports journalist, pharmacist, and retired president of the Cape Cod Baseball League, and Dorothy Savarese, chair and CEO of Cape Cod 5. She's also been appointed by the Federal Reserve and the FDIC to serve in advisory roles and served as chair of the American Bankers Association. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Danielle is giving us a call from Chatham. Hi, Danielle.
Hi, good morning, everyone. Really appreciate this conversation, so thanks for having it. I wanted to chime in because as someone who identifies as a woman, growing up as a girl, you know, I got called bossy, but told that one day I would be a good leader, and I knew that. And so always had this assumption about myself that I was a leader, but I didn't know what that meant or how that could show up in my professional life. And the leadership that I saw all around me was, it was male modeled, you know, it was the leadership I was seeing was a patriarchal style of leadership, very top down. And that never really resonated for me. And one thing that I found along the way is something called the Rockwood Leadership Institute. And they are very much focused on developing leadership from the inside out, a personal style of leadership that is purpose driven. And I have found it to be so, so valuable in my professional life and in my personal life, because I heard, you know, one participant say they didn't like the word authentic. But I will say it does focus on an authentic style of leadership that I think is really important for people who identify as women or across the gender spectrum to have different styles of leadership that we're bringing into the professional world that is kind of breaking a white supremacist patriarchal model of leadership that has been the norm in our institutions for, you know, centuries. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to share that and ask if any of the participants have any experience with the Rockwood Leadership Institute or anything similar like that that they would recommend to other women or women, people who identify as women.
Yeah. Danielle, thank you for the call. Anybody have thoughts on that?
I have a reaction to it, but I haven't worked with the Rockwood Leadership Institute. And this is, you know, this is just the perfect example of all of us together are stronger than any of us, right? Is that we've mm-hmm. just gotten really important information that was shared from that caller. So thank you. She brought out so many important points, which is, and I just want to just anecdotally, one of the turning points in my life was when I became incredibly frustrated with the male-dominated sort of patriarchal methodologies of leadership in my industry. I had a fabulous boss, Bruce Hammett, who hired me originally here, who said, well, turn that around somehow, and got to reframing that. So I did a tremendous amount of study on the impact of different leadership styles and the impact of diversity. And one of the things that's so encouraging is there is an incredible amount of empirical data that shows that the combination of leadership styles leads to more effective organizations, that diversity in management actually leads to more effective organizations. Mm-hmm. So the point that, you know, leadership doesn't mean emulating something that you've seen or pre-existing, but instead developing and leveraging your own skills in terms of helping people achieve goals and mm-hmm. self-actualize is an important redefinition of leadership. And I also loved that she reframed our conversation about gender, is that she was very careful to say that she identifies as female. I think, you know, it's important for us to have these conversations in an inclusive way so that we make sure that we're representing or what we're trying to do is uplift people of all folks along the continuum of, you know, LGBTQIA plus,
mm-hmm. right.
as well as cisgender individuals. And that all of these concepts can help all of them get to, whether it's genuine or authentic, their own style of leadership to help self-actualize themselves as well as to support others.
Yeah. Anybody want to add anything to that? That was great.
Wow. Right off the cuff, Dorothy. Nice job.
I just loved it.
Yeah. So how have attitudes toward women leaders changed, and what stereotypes about women still need to be overcome? Judy, let's start with you. I mean, did you get, I'm just thinking, I remember years ago, a radio station I worked at, and I had, a male employee, and I had made a female his boss. He had a real problem with that. He did not want a woman telling him what to do. And that was, we had a real struggle with that. I don't know if we see it as much today as we used to. Maybe it's a little quieter, but I don't know. Judy, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that's a good choice of words. I think it is a little quieter now, but very often, I mean, I still hear, you know, a strong woman as a leader who is giving orders because that is her job. Hopefully she's doing it in a nice way. But sometimes, you know, she'll get labeled as the witch or whatever other word you want to put in there. And if she's not showing good leadership and she's kind of Casper Milquetoast, then she's a doormat.
Right.
So it's really, it's a fine line. I think for women, you just have to wear the leadership role as well as you can. And I think kindness is part of it. I think, you know, learning how to talk to people and maybe gently instruct people or show people what they need to be doing. I think, you know, it comes back to, I think we have to work harder than guys do in our role. And and I'll probably take that to my grave.
Sandy, in your book, you write about an experience when you were superintendent of the Coast Guard Academy. You were invited to observe an engineering class, and the instructor asked you to pay attention to the difference in participation of the men and the women in the class. Describe what you observed.
That's a great question. Thank you for the opportunity, Mindy. Yes, when I was superintendent or the equivalent of president at the Coast Guard Academy, I was watching this electrical engineering class, and it's a small class. You had maybe 20 young people in there. Maybe two were women, because even though the academy at the time had achieved a 35% representation of women, still in the engineering, especially electrical, women were not represented at the same ratio as their attendance at the academy. So I watched the instructor go through the class and call, you know, ask for cadets who had an answer to raise their hands. And that's a typical way that classrooms can operate, is raise your hand if you got an answer. And a lot of colleges grade you on participation. So if you're not raising your hand, you're maybe having 15% of your grade is non-participatory. But the men, they have no problem shooting their hand. Have you ever noticed that? The men's hands go up really fast. And they'll answer if they've got 30, 40% of the answer, they'll say something just to participate. And the woman will sit there and will not raise her hand. So this instructor called on one of the women, one of the two women, or maybe it was the only woman in that class. He called on her specifically by name and said, "Cadet Smith, what do you think?" And she thought for a minute and gave the perfectly correct answer of a tough question, but she wasn't going to raise her hand and volunteer to answer that. So this instructor said, "Look, if you want to provide a classroom where everybody can succeed, you can't just ask the loudest for volunteers, because the loudest extroverts are going to raise their hand, and the quieter ones, be they women, be they minorities, be they people with personalities that are introverted, they're going to get left behind. So you need, as a leader, to call out and make sure that everybody's included and given a fair opportunity."
Good point. Anybody want to add anything?
Yeah, that's such an important point. There's really two elements here. One is recognizing that there actually are differences in terms of how men and women react to different circumstances. There's been a lot of research done, for example, on the percentage of qualifications that a man or a woman feels that they need to have in order to apply for a job. And as you can imagine, a woman typically in these studies finds that, you know, will not apply until they feel that they have 90% of the skill sets or more. With men, it ranges between 50 and 60%. So you have to design systems, whether it's calling on an individual in the class as opposed to waiting for hand raising, or other performance management systems, to make sure that you're offsetting that. But there's another side of this too, which is unconscious bias. And that is, in one of the things, because I thought this is where Sandy was going to go, when they ask people to observe how well individuals did in meetings, typically, again, what they find is, although the male and female participants participated equally and with similar quality, people tend to notice what the men have done. So again, this is the idea of unearthing unconscious bias, helping people recognize it, because that itself is part of the solution, and then devising situations to address that.
We are living in a time when a woman is holding the office of Vice President of the United States for the first time. We've come a long way, but there's still a long way to go, right? So what are some of the milestones you'll be looking for as evidence that we're on the right path to diversifying leadership in the private and public sector? Sandy, you're nodding your head. Go ahead.
oh, I'm nodding my head because I know it's a complicated question. And I came into the Coast Guard in 1978. And certainly things are far better now in the armed forces and our society than they were 40 some odd years ago. But you would never know it because expectations have risen even higher than progress has risen. So one of the challenges I faced as an early woman, one of the first, was that the system tried too hard to help me get ahead, to provide women in more senior roles to get help them get ahead so that you'd have representation. But they would skip across merit, and they would give you opportunities based on your gender, which just creates resentment. And it makes it so that those unconscious biases have a foundation. Mm-hmm. So I would argue they're not really unconscious biases. They're based in what people have observed and seen. And so we can't try too hard to elevate women and minorities into roles that they might not be necessarily all the way ready for, or they might be better qualified candidates. So I will see success when promotions and boards assignments and everything are based on merit and performance and how you've done and how qualified you are, not the tone of your skin or your gender.
Right. Judy?
I'm going out to buy Sandy's book as soon as this ends. I said to Dorothy last night in a text, I just want to sit back and listen to the two of you, and I want to take notes. And now I'm already through one notebook, so I am going out to buy Sandy's book. I have learned so much from two incredible, well, three, because Mindy, you're in there too.
Oh, you are too.
What an unbelievable experience. I mean, in a perfect world, I think people should be judged by their performance, by their merit, by what they can bring to the table, and not the color of their skin, not the color of their hair, not their gender, but that's in a perfect world. Right. If people could just look at each other as equal and everyone is judged by, as I said, by what they can bring to the table, by their merit, by their performance.
Mm-hmm. Dorothy?
So I might take a little bit of a different tack, because I think what Sandy identified was an objective that wasn't effectively executed. And so to me, a perfect world is, yes, where we get to, absolute equality between genders, races, sexes, et cetera. But to get there, I think, takes actual overt action. And so it would be empowering women to be able to perform effectively in leadership positions, making sure that we are supporting people of color and the disenfranchised, that bringing them into whatever systems that they're marginalized on. So I get that previous experiments and challenges have been difficult, but progress will only be made, in my mind, with very overt effort. I've been named to 25 most powerful women in banking for the last 9 years. And I'm hoping that, and our collective hope is, we'll get to a day when there is no need for 25 mm-hmm. most powerful women mm-hmm. in banking. Right. And so the goal, though, has to be accompanied by conscious and in intentional action.
Right. And Sandy, you're giving a virtual talk about your book on June 29th through Falmouth Museums on the Green. And we'll post links about your book and the talk at our website, capeandislands.org. Sandy Stows is the Vice Admiral in the U.S. Coast Guard, retired, first woman to head the Coast Guard Academy, and her new book is Breaking Ice and Breaking Glass, Leading in Uncharted Waters. Judy Walden Scarafile, sports journalist, pharmacist, and retired president of the Cape Cod Baseball League, and Dorothy Savarese, chair and CEO of Cape Cod 5. Thank you all for being here. What a fabulous conversation this morning. Really appreciate your sharing your expertise with us. Thank you.
It's great Thank to you, be Mindy. With you all. Thank you.
Thank you, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.